is Monday, October 11th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington. Taiwan's president is defiant in the wake of what many say are aggressive moves by China over the island nation.
We will continue to bolster our national defense and demonstrate our determination to defend ourselves in order to ensure that nobody can force Taiwan to take the path China has laid out for us.
An Austrian prime minister has announced that he will step down amidst allegations of corruption. Human rights organizations are calling on the international community, and specifically the U.S., to promote and protect women's rights in Afghanistan.
We all know that there's restrictions inside of Afghanistan for women and girls, and those are just increasing.
Iraq is voted Sunday in parliamentary elections months ahead of schedule as a concession to youth-led popular uprisings against corruption and mismanagement in the country. We'll have these stories and more coming up right here on International Edition. Stay tuned. And for our top story, opponents of Texas' strict abortion ban are taking aim at companies that donated money to the bill's sponsors through television and digital ads. AP correspondent Julie Walker reports.
They're hoping consumers will pressure corporate America to join the fight against a surge of restrictions. The ads highlight AT&T's donations to Texas Republicans who sponsored the bill. The company also donated to Democrats and says it does not take a position on abortion or endorse the law. There are plans to expand the ads to Florida, where a similar proposal has been introduced. Meanwhile, late Friday, a federal appeals court reinstated the law just 2 days after a lower court suspended it. Now the question is whether it goes to the Supreme Court. I'm Julie Walker.
Austrian Prime Minister Sebastian Kurz has announced that he will step down amidst allegations of corruption. AP's Karen Chalmers reports.
Speaking at a news conference, Kurz announced that he has proposed to Austria's president that Foreign Minister Alexander Schallenberg become chancellor. What we need now are stable conditions, so in order to resolve the stalemate, I want to make way to prevent chaos and ensure stability. The move comes as he attempts to defuse a government crisis triggered by the prosecutor's announcement that he is a target of a corruption investigation. Kurz and his associates are accused of using public money to pay for positive reports in the media, as well as manipulating polls in order to secure his rise to the leadership of his party in the country. However, Kurz has said he will become the head of his conservative Austrian People's Party's parliamentary group, remaining in a key position in the front line. I'm Karen Chamas.
Iraq is voted Sunday in parliamentary elections held months ahead of schedule as a concession to a youth-led popular uprising against corruption and mismanagement. This is the sixth election since the fall of Saddam Hussein and the U.S.-led invasion of Iraq in 2003. But the voting was marked by widespread apathy and a boycott by many of the young activists who thronged the streets of Baghdad and Iraq's southern provinces in late 2019. AP's Karen Chalmers joins us again with more on this story.
Iraq is holding its sixth election since the fall of Saddam Hussein and the U.S.-led invasion of Iraq in 2003. A total of 3,449 candidates are vying for 329 seats in the parliamentary elections. Security was tight throughout the country to ensure Iraqis could go out to vote safely. EU chief observer Viola Van Cramon said the day had been going well.
So far, we have not seen any major incidents. It was, I think, a regular opening.
In the Shiite holy city of Najaf, Iraq's influential cleric Muqtada al-Sadr cast his ballot, swarmed by local journalists. Al-Sadr won the majority of seats in the 2018 elections. This year, a tight race is expected between his party and the Fatah Alliance, led by paramilitary leader Hadi al-Amiri. Apathy and security concerns have kept many voters away from the polls, as Prime Minister Mustafa al-Kadhimi urged Iraqis to come out and vote. I'm Karen Chamas.
And Taiwan says that it will not bow to pressure and nobody can force it to accept the path that China has laid out for the island nation. Taiwan's president Tsai Ing-wen said Sunday as the island celebrated its national day amid heightened tensions with Beijing that her country was facing, quote, the most complex situation in the past 72 years since the end of the Chinese Civil War. Reuters has more.
Fighter jets paraded across Taiwan's skies on Sunday, marking the island's national day. Addressing a rally outside the presidential office in Taipei, leader Tsai Ing-wen continued to rebuff comments made by Chinese President Xi Jinping, who said he wanted to see a peaceful reunification with Taiwan.
We will continue to bolster our national defense and demonstrate our determination to defend ourselves in order to ensure that nobody can force Taiwan to take the path China has laid out for us, a path that offers neither a free and democratic way of life for Taiwan.
China has long claimed Taiwan as its own territory, with the island facing growing military and political pressure to accept Beijing's rule. That includes repeated Chinese Air Force missions in Taiwan's airspace, which Tsai says has seriously affected national security and aviation safety. China's activities there have been condemned internationally. Tsai's speech comes a day after Xi vowed to realize China's reunification with Taiwan. Although he didn't directly mention the use of force, his comments drew an angry backlash from Taipei. Tsai said only Taiwan's people can decide the future.
We will not act rashly, but there should be absolutely no illusions that the Taiwanese people will bow to pressure.
Though Taiwan has repeatedly called for talks with Beijing, it refuses to deal with her and instead has branded her a separatist. She warned her people on Sunday, quote, "We do not have the privilege of letting down our guard."
Outgoing German Chancellor Angela Merkel was in Israel Sunday, meeting with Israeli leaders. She called on Iran to return to negotiations on a new nuclear deal. Under her leadership, Israel and Germany have had close relations, including cooperation on Iran and its nuclear program. The visit comes as Iran says that it has 120 kilograms of enriched uranium. Linda Gratstein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The trip marked the eighth time that Germany's Angela Merkel had traveled to Israel since she became chancellor 16 years ago. And in her last official visit, the Israeli cabinet held a special session in her honor. Under her leadership, Germany has become Israel's closest friend in Europe, with close cooperation on all issues, including Iran. Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett used the occasion to warn the world that Iran is moving closer to a nuclear bomb. He said that Iran's nuclear program is at its most advanced point ever, adding, "The world waits, the Iranians delay, and the centrifuges spin." Merkel said that Israel's security will always be important to Germany, no matter who leads Germany. She also urged Iran to return to negotiations on a future nuclear deal. Her visit came as Iranian officials announced they had enriched 120 kilograms of uranium to 20%. Iran has maintained its nuclear program is for peaceful purposes. The original 2015 agreement among Iran, Germany, China, France, Russia, Britain, and the United States, known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, JCPOA, provided Iran with relief from sanctions in exchange for limits on its nuclear program. Israel opposed the agreement, saying it could pave the way for Iran to become a nuclear power eventually. And Israeli officials welcomed the 2018 decision by then U.S. President Donald Trump to leave the deal. Since then, they say Iran has moved forward on getting a bomb and is closer than ever. Chancellor Merkel also visited Yad Vashem, Israel's Holocaust memorial. Merkel said that she considers it a stroke of good fortune given to us by history, that after the crimes against humanity that were the Shoah, it has been possible to reset and reestablish relations between Germany and Israel to the extent that we have done. She said that the situation with Iran is difficult, but that without an agreement with Tehran, it will be even more difficult. Merkel's meeting with Bennett followed talks between the Israeli leader and U.S. President Joe Biden in Washington in August. Biden has offered to rejoin the deal if Iran returns to full compliance with its nuclear provisions. The U.S. and Iran have held indirect talks about rejoining the accord if Tehran returns to full compliance with its nuclear terms. Talks, however, have stalled. Linda Gradstein for VOA News, Jerusalem.
You're listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. I'm Jackson Vunganyi. A U.S. delegation met with senior Taliban representatives in Doha this weekend in their first face-to-face meeting at a senior level since Washington pulled its troops from Afghanistan. The high-level U.S. delegations includes officials from the State Department, USAID, and the U.S. intelligence community. And even though no details of the talks have been released as yet, it was said that the U.S. will press the Taliban to ensure continued safe passage for U.S. citizens and others out of Afghanistan. Human rights organizations and aid agencies are hoping that one of the most critical issues that should be raised at the meeting is the fate of women's rights in the country after the hardline group took over power in August. Reports show that even though the Taliban initially pledged a softer version of their repressive regime of the 1990s, it has already begun tightening their control of women's freedoms. A new report from Refugees International titled Afghan Women and Girls Under Immediate Threat, The Responsibility to Protect and Assist is just beginning, is calling on the U.S. and the international community to put pressure on the Taliban to ensure access to education for women and girls and to allow for those seeking meaningful refuge outside of the country. Devon Cohn is the senior advocate for women and girls at Refugees International. She's the author of the report. She says that in just over 2 months after taking power, the Taliban have already begun to erase the gains that Afghan women have made over the last 20 years.
I think, like you mentioned, it's certainly a humanitarian crisis, but as all, pretty much all humanitarian crises, it does affect women, and it is affecting women disproportionately, and especially inside of Afghanistan. We all know that there's restrictions inside of Afghanistan for women and girls, and those are just increasing as the Taliban, continues to govern and wield their power. And so, it is different province by province, but overall, women and girls are really being affected by this humanitarian crisis because they are experiencing higher rates of gender-based violence than they otherwise would. They are having food insecurity issues. They aren't able to access the humanitarian aid in the same way that men are. As is the case in most humanitarian crises, women and girls in Afghanistan are bearing the brunt of this crisis that is only getting worse.
Right after the Taliban took over, I think in August, there were these protests around major cities, including in Kabul, with these women demanding their rights. How did the Taliban react to this show of defiance?
Well, as is reported, the Taliban did not react well. There were shootings. There was really a crackdown. And what I think is important is why these women protested. I mean, there's a lot of reasons why, but one of the things that's also in the report is the fact that 11 million Afghan women are under the age of 25. Women and girls are under the age of 25. And so you've got a huge number of women and girls in the country that have grown up not under Taliban rule. So to immediately and quickly and as dramatically as we've seen happen, for them to have their rights restricted, they're just, I think they're just not going to take it. I mean, many of them are standing up and we're seeing crackdowns, but I think that it's important to recognize that, a lot of women and girls have grown up with the expectations that they would have rights and education and access to opportunities, and to see that all disappear so quickly once the U.S. and other European powers and others have left, that's really dramatic and problematic for them.
During the first Taliban regime, many women virtually disappeared from the public eye as they were banned from either working or were not allowed to travel without a guardian, or which is a male guardian. Are the women that the Taliban left behind when they lost power the same as they found this time around? And how is that manifesting in how, both these groups, the women rights activists and the new Taliban rulers, in the way they're relating to each other 2 months after the takeover?
Sure. Well, that's a great question, because that's exactly what you said. The women that the Taliban are finding now are different than the ones that they were interacting with when they were in power before. And so I think that one of the things that people are saying is that the Taliban might not have changed, but Afghans have, Afghan women and men. And so I think they are finding that they need to operate differently. They need to allow for some rights. I mean, I would advocate for, all human rights to be respected, but they do have a different rhetoric. That is what has changed with the Taliban too. So in terms of the question of, has the Taliban changed since the last time they took power? I couldn't really speak to that. I don't know, but I do know that they're saying things differently. They're portraying themselves as different. And what we really have to see is, how does that manifest in the next few months, in the next right. 6 months, in the next year? You know, is it just rhetoric? Is it just for public consumption in the West? Or is it really going to have an effect and an impact on how they rule Afghanistan?
That was Devon Kohn, Senior Advocate for Women and Girls at Refugees International here in Washington, D.C. The Nobel Peace Prize has been awarded to journalists Maria Ressa of Philippines and Dmitry Muratov of Russia for their longstanding efforts to safeguard freedom of expression in the Philippines and in Russia. Ressa is the CEO of Rappler, a news outlet critical of Philippine President Rodrigo Duterte's regime. From the Philippines capital, Manila, reporter Stanley Buenafe Gajete brings us this exclusive interview with Nobel Prize winner Ressa, done earlier this year before winning the prestigious award.
Philippines veteran journalist Maria Ressa has been awarded the prestigious Nobel Peace Prize this year for her efforts to safeguard freedom of expression in the country. The Norwegian Nobel Committee announced on Friday that Ressa, the CEO of online news site Rappler, was named along with Russia's Dmitry Muratov for their courageous fight for freedom of expression, according to Chairwoman Berit Reiss-Andersen of the Norwegian Nobel Committee during the news conference. She also added that they are representatives of all journalists who stand up for this ideal in a world in which democracy and freedom of the press face increasingly adverse conditions. In an exclusive interview I made to Maria Ressa earlier this year, Maria Ressa answered my hypothetical question about being nominated and be awarded soon. Ressa expressed her feelings and her thoughts on the importance of the award in the society.
Well, first of all, thank you for the Norwegian lawmaker who nominated not just myself, but yes. CPJ and RSF, right? So CPJ and RSF, right?
Yes.
And then IFCN, the International Fact-Checking Network, was nominated separately. I think it just shows you how important facts are today, you know, and that the mission of journalism has never been as important, because it truly is a battle for facts. Because without facts, you can't have a shared reality. You can't debate. You can't have democracy. You can't have any meaningful human engagement.
Maria Ressa also said that in order to eject the truth, there are risks and pitfalls that she needs to fight. And all of these are part of her journalistic journey to uphold the truth and hold the line.
The risks are significantly higher. The risks. I mean, you know, I have to think about going to jail in order to do my job. How crazy is that, right? If you would have told me that 5 years ago, I would have, you know, said, the Philippines, that would never happen. Well, yeah, it happened.
Ressa also said the dangers of the new technology in proliferating disinformation, especially during the COVID-19 pandemic. In 2016, the populist Philippine leader, President Rodrigo Duterte, won the presidency through the use of social media. His diehard fans and supporters are using this technology, even up to now, to discredit the journalist and to counteract reliable and validated facts from the media.
The world is so different, but it looks the same. And I think that this is a pivotal year in defining what the new world is going to be. You know, the dangers of technology, the dangers of social media as the main distributor of news. I think we're seeing this impact in all countries, the democracies around the world, where cheap armies are rolling back democracy, where we are being insidiously manipulated. And then I think the second thing is, you know, it's with the coronavirus, lies kill. And so what you find in all of our countries is oftentimes the very same networks that are used for political disinformation are the same ones that actually are anti-vaxxers.
Ressa, in 2012, co-founded Rappler, which gave critical attention on the Duterte regime's controversial, murderous anti-drug campaign. Ms. Ressa and Rappler documented how social media is being used to spread fake news, harass opponents, and manipulate public discourse, as the number of deaths is so high that the campaign resembles a war waged against the country's own population. Since Duterte was swept to power in 2016, Ressa and Rappler have endured what media advocates say is a grinding series of criminal charges arrests, investigations, and online attacks. Duterte has called Rappler a fake news outlet, and Reza has been the target of abusive messages online.
First, I was shocked, and then second is, I think it's a reflection of the world we live in today and a reflection of how my government, how the Duterte administration is perceived by the rest of the world and what it takes to hold power to account in the Philippines.
Maria Ressa said her Nobel Peace Prize was for all journalists around the world as she vowed to continue her battle for press freedom. Philippine press groups and right activists hailed Reza's award as a triumph in a country ranked as one of the world's most dangerous for journalists. Even international leaders and personalities congratulated Maria Ressa for the award. However, Duterte and the whole palace did not give any message for Ressa's victory. The Nobel Peace Prize will be presented on December 10, the anniversary of the death of Swedish industrialist Alfred Nobel, who founded the awards in his 1895 will. For VOA News, I am Stanley Buenafegehete in Manila, Philippines.
And in other news, Abdul Qadir Khan, the man known as the father of Pakistan's nuclear bomb, died Sunday of COVID-19 following a lengthy illness, that is according to his family. He was 85 years old. Khan, who launched Pakistan on the path to becoming a nuclear weapons power in the 70s, died in a hospital in the capital, Islamabad. For more on this story and other breaking global news, visit our website at voanews.com. And while there, check out our other programs, including podcasts of shows Upfront, a television show Africa 54, Straight Talk Africa, and many others. And remember to connect with us on our YouTube channel. Search for VOA Africa. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Jackson Bunganyi. Did you ever wonder why you didn't get your wisdom teeth until you were an adult? Well, researchers at Arizona State University and the University of Arizona say that they have an answer. Rick Pantaleo has more with today's Science in a Minute.
This is Science in a Minute.
Each of the three pair of adult molars appear in humans around ages 6, 12, and 18, and 3, 6, and 12 years of age in our closest primate relative, the chimpanzee. Scientists say humans mature slower than other primates. In their study, the authors suggest there must be a balance between human facial growth and how chewing muscles work, since this can affect where and when our adult molars appear. They say that the synchronization of these two factors is important to make sure that there is enough mechanically safe space for the molars to emerge. They add that molars that appear before the right time could disrupt the precise function of the entire chewing system by causing damage to the TMJ or jaw joint. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Voice of America!
United Nations monitors are finding a significant rise in casualties in eastern Ukraine since Russian-backed separatists ended a ceasefire agreement with the government in Kiev earlier this year. The report by a human rights monitoring mission in Ukraine was submitted to the UN Human Rights Council. Elisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The report covers human rights developments in Ukraine from February to the end of July. It finds 15 civilians have been killed and 47 injured since fighting escalated in eastern Ukraine's Luhansk and Donetsk regions. It notes this is a 51% increase over the previous 6 months. UN Deputy High Commissioner for Human Rights Nada Al-Nashif says UN monitors have documented 13 cases of arbitrary detention related to the conflict in territory controlled by armed groups. She adds 11 remain in detention.
Both self-proclaimed republics issued decrees in March and April establishing the forced recruitment of 400 men into armed groups. Another decree issued on the 1st of October established the recruitment of a further 500 men. This exposes male civilians to involuntary lethal danger, stripping them of the protection afforded to civilians by international humanitarian law, and opens them to the risk of criminal prosecution.
The report says an atmosphere of fear and self-censorship prevails in territory controlled by armed groups. It underscores the self-proclaimed republics continue to restrict freedom of religion, especially that of evangelical Christians. Al-Nashif says the government of Ukraine also has a checkered human rights record. For example, she cites 22 documented cases of threats and attacks against journalists, human rights defenders, LGBTI people, and national minorities, among others.
Hate speech was also directed against Roma, LGBTI persons, women, persons with disabilities, and people perceived to have pro-Russian views. It is imperative that the authorities effectively investigate each such incident in full, acknowledging any bias motives.
The UN monitoring mission accuses Russia of multiple violations of civil liberties and fair trial rights in the Crimean Peninsula, which it illegally annexed in 2014. The report documents cases of torture and ill treatment against Ukrainian citizens in Crimea. The Ukrainian ambassador to the UN Geneva, Filipenko Yevhenia, said millions of Ukrainians living in Russian-occupied territories continue to be deprived of their fundamental rights and freedoms. She criticized efforts by Russia to legitimize its annexation of Crimea. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The Lebanese Central Bank says that it rejects any change to the exchange rate used to withdraw cash in Lebanese pounds from U.S. dollar accounts in the absence of a comprehensive plan for the economy, which is in deep financial crisis. Hard currency has dried up in Lebanon since it slumped into a major financial meltdown in 2019, and savers with U.S. dollar accounts have only been able to make withdrawals in Lebanese pounds at an exchange rate of 3,900 pounds to the dollar. George Eid Hasmo from Beirut.
In Lebanon today, there are at least four vastly different exchange rates at which the Lebanese pound is exchanged into U.S. dollars. The result means people have to go through a daily struggle with misery and absurdity. Since the start of the economic crisis in 2019, and to prevent Lebanese from withdrawing dollars deposited, the central bank decided that the rate of withdrawal of dollars from the banks is 3,900 Lebanese pounds. Even if the black market rate today is more than 17,000 Lebanese pounds to the dollar. Arsène Garabedian, who lives with his family in central Lebanon, finds the situation difficult.
Actually, there's a big difference in the prices between shops, banks, exchange shops, and salaries. I don't know which one I should follow. Honestly, it's really confusing.
Meanwhile, Lebanese still have to pay their old U.S. dollars debts or transactions on the exchange rate of the Lebanese pound before the crisis, which is 1,500 to the dollar. Stephanie, who runs a company in Beirut, says that paying her debts and employees has become a complicated equation.
Since there are so many rates that are being used, starting with the banks, it's 3,900. Regarding the employees, being an employee at a company, sometimes you get paid at 2,000 lira, or 2,500, or 3,000, or maybe at the same rate as the official bank rate.
A fourth and fifth exchange rate exist, and it's 2,500 Lebanese pounds or 4,500 Lebanese pounds to the dollar. A choice that a few private companies have decided to make in order to pay the salaries of their employees while helping them to cope with the inflation without paying the extremely high black market exchange rate. Senior economic analyst Jesse Trott-Kastoun explained that things are not going to change in the near future.
The scarcity of dollar has led to a prosperous black market, where the demand is always higher than the offer.
The new Lebanese government has vowed during its last meeting this week to tackle the issue of the devaluing of the Lebanese pound without giving any details on how it intends to do this. This is George Aid, reporting for VOA from Beirut.
This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thank you so much for listening. Be sure to visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day at voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington. Be well, be safe, and have a great week ahead.